Welcome to Killer Women with your host, best-selling author, Danielle Girard. And now, Danielle's next Killer Woman.
Hello, and welcome to Killer Women Podcast, a proud member of the Authors on the Air global network with more than 4 million listeners. I am your host, suspense author Danielle Girard, and my guest today is L.K. Bowen. Debut author Lynn Bowen was born in Boston and made her way to Los Angeles to work in the entertainment industry. Like Ellie, her protagonist in For Worse, Bowen has the degenerative eye disease retinitis pigmentosa, which is slowly destroying her vision. To learn more about RP and other degenerative retinal diseases, or to contribute to finding treatments and cures, please visit www.fightingblindness.org. Welcome, Lynn.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
It's so fun. We don't do spoilers, but I will tell you the end of this book. I was like, oh no, oh boy. It's a big twist at the very end, which was super fun. So tell us about this. The book has an interesting format. Tell us a little bit about For Worse, this sort of storyline.
Well, the story is about Ellie, who, as it said in the bio, like me, she has retinitis pigmentosa, which is destroying her peripheral vision and her night vision. So she is operating with a challenge in her life. She is trapped in an unhappy marriage to a man who is very controlling and difficult. And she left him once and came back because she ran out of money and nerve. And now she's planning on leaving him again. And to bolster herself in this decision, she joins a group of women on a chat room on the internet called Divorced Women Over 50, or DWOF.
Which I love.
As we call it. And she meets these extraordinary women there. They're actually ordinary, extraordinary women. And she gets into their stories, and there are mysteries within the chat room itself, and people disappear, and people have other stories. And she herself tells her story sometimes through the chat room, but it's not just that. It's largely narrative in the chat room, or just these forays. And then at some point she decides this isn't working for her. And she gets a recommendation from the moderator to join another chat room that happens to be on the dark web for women for whom divorce was not the right decision. And they have another way of navigating a bad marriage.
Right, they do. They do indeed. It's so like you said, a lot of this, the format of the book is these wonderful chat groups. And we do get the point of view of the husband, but largely it's a women's book, which of course, you know, is my favorite subject of all times. And a lot of it, as everybody who's listened to my podcast knows, I'm recently divorced. It was not my choice. It was my choice, but I didn't really have a choice because he had had a long affair. So many of the things that they talk about and the ways that they, you know, feel so real to me. So I love that, because I think one of the things about navigating anything really hard, right, in life is feeling like you are understood in some way. And I think that's what Ellie finds in this chat group. That's what I find when I'm reading books that you know, that deal with these issues. So I think it's a comfort. So if you're out there and you're in a hard marriage, which I think maybe is just the definition of marriage, right? But you have, but if you have, you know, those thoughts in your head, it's fun. There's moments where I laughed out loud, which I think is another thing that's really hard to do and nice to do when you're going through something really tough. So I really appreciated that. And Ellie, you know, and so let's talk about this disease, because the way it's described it really does. I mean, and her husband really uses it against her. Like you said, he's controlling, and he puts her in uncomfortable situations, mostly just for his own sort of, you know, kicks, which it makes us understand why she wants out. But tell us what it does. Like, you know, it sort of starts to really narrow your vision.
That's exactly right. It does narrow your vision. I like to tell people it's not exactly like looking through a roll of toilet paper, but it's sort of like if your vision is kind of a square, and you can't see above or below or to the sides. So you really have to, I walk with a white cane,
Yeah.
I'm okay in the daylight because it, for some reason, the daylight sort of broadens the periphery a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But at night, the lights go out. And if I'm in a dark restaurant or in a crowded street, I need the cane and I need the arm of someone, you know, who doesn't mind, you know, leaning
Right.
a bit. And for someone who is in a marriage with a person who is using it to hurt her,
Yeah.
It's terrifying. And, you know, the thing about Jeff is he's not doing it because he likes to pull the wings off of flies.
Right.
He's doing it because he is terrified of her leaving him. And so he wants to make her know how dependent she must become on him, as opposed to a really supportive partner would be saying, go do it yourself. You know, I'm here,
yeah.
but you don't need me. You know,
Right.
That's to be disabled is to yearn for independence.
Right.
And to fight for it every step of the way, which is what she learns to do. And I think part of her struggle is this the right thing to do? I mean, if I am disabled, if I'm going to be blind in 5 years, shouldn't I be married? Shouldn't I have someone in my corner? And they have a daughter. They have a daughter who's in college, Hannah.
Yeah.
And she doesn't want to burden her daughter, of
No, of
course.
course. Right.
And so she has to decide, you know, what price freedom, really.
Right. Right. And the children in general become a factor in divorce, right? I mean, I know for a lot of people, the children are not necessarily, you know, they don't necessarily see the sides of their parents that are sort of would be hard to live with. I mean, of course, all children complain about their parents, right? But Hannah's actually quite supportive of her mother and realizes the ways in which Jeff is, you know, not an easy partner for Ellie. But like you said, like Ellie is in a tough position. And is that what happens? Like, eventually, become blind?
Yes. In fact, I'm extremely lucky with this disease because I have so much disease. I was diagnosed at 21, and people who are diagnosed at 21 are blind by 40.
Wow.
And I'm 68, and I have a lot of vision, and I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful every day. And one of the things I want to tell people is be grateful for what you can see.
Right.
And hear, you know,
right.
It's a big gift.
Well, first of all, you don't look 68, although that's the new, you know, 38, I'm sure.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. But also that is amazing. Like, yeah, I mean, 20, that's 30 years of, you know, vision that now, is it congenital? Like, is it an inherited disease? Do they know what causes it?
They do. It's there are many different types and there's many different genes. They're looking for the gene because if they find the gene, they can do an effective gene replacement therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So they say, and that's, we contribute, I do fundraising for the Foundation Fighting Blindness every year for their vision walk. And they do great work in funding the research that will end this disease. Yes, the end game is you're probably going to be blind, but I don't know. My brother was the only one who had this disease in our family. He passed in 2009 of cancer. It's not related.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Our parents didn't have it. My sister doesn't have it. None of our children have it.
Oh, which is lovely. Yeah.
Thank God.
Right.
So it's a tricky little thing. And I think that makes
yeah.
it hard. You know, families that have it onto the generations.
Yeah. Know? Right. And so your grandparents didn't, nobody you know had it until you and your brother.
Correct. My grandparents actually both died. They were hit by a car. My father's parents were hit by a car. And it's possible they were hit by a car because somebody didn't see it. You know what I'm saying? Is this disease
yeah.
known or diagnosed until, you
right.
know, within the last 50 years, maybe?
Right, right. Absolutely. Well, you know, it is an interesting question because obviously, like, you know, we assume Ellie got married, you know, pretty, this generation of people I got married at 23. So if you assume
baby.
I know, I wouldn't recommend it. But no, I had 30 wonderful years. But I just feel like, you know, if you got married really young and you didn't sort of know, a lot of us do these things, right? We get married when we're young and we don't know sort of what sort of genetic health lottery we're going to end up with. And so, right, she's, you know, if you imagine she's not, didn't have a lot of opportunity to live on her own before she was with Jeff, it is, I mean, there's so many things about it. And you don't even need, you certainly don't need to have, you know, a physical handicap to feel like being, like divorcing is terrifying. Right. That is the true, that is, was my experience. And that the people that I have spoken to, that is experience. It's just like the idea of navigating the world. First of all, we're women, which of course means we're smarter, stronger, braver, more fabulous.
Yeah, all that.
But we're also the underpaid sex, you know, gender. Yeah. We're the, you know, the more at risk gender for all sorts of things, right? And it is, there is this terrifying idea of like, can we do this? And you see all of this, I think, in the characters in For Worse, because, you know, many of, and we were taught, we were raised, and even my, I feel like young for this generation of people that were raised to be like, you sort of are the support, you're the wingman, wingwoman to your husband. You're not supposed to be your own star. And I hopefully our children, like my daughter is, of course, like just so fierce. And she is like, there's no effing way I'm going to be anybody's sidekick. And I love that. And my son 100%, I think, will have a partner who is his equal. And I don't think my husband thought of me as his, not as equal. But I think his, because he was the main breadwinner, his life sort of took, you know, front row. What he needed to go or do, or if he was going to golf on Wednesdays, it was my responsibility to just like sort of pick up the slack. And I think it does make us feel like we maybe can't do it by ourselves, right?
I think, you know, there's an old saying, a man works from dusk till dawn, but a woman's work is never done.
Yeah. Because
when you come home from work, you do take care of the kids and you want to.
Of course.
I wanted to give my kids baths and read them stories when I came home from work because I didn't see them the whole day.
Right. You know, right.
The thing I wanted to make the point of, though, and for worse, is that emotional and psychological abuse are just as devastating as physical abuse. You just don't feel justified in making a stink about it because you think, oh, I'm being thin-skinned, or just go fight, you know, go stand your ground, fight back. You know, there's all these things. And I wanted to make the point that none of these women have been physically abused in any of my chapters. Now, this is not the case in real life, of course.
Of course, yeah.
I don't say, you know, one is better, worse, whatever, than the other.
No, so, we shouldn't have to categorize, right.
Exactly. But, and I think someone says, you know, there is a tendency, if you are being emotionally or physically or psychologically abused, to just go along with it because the scars aren't visible.
Yeah.
I think I had a couple of drafts under my belt of this book, and I had a friend who was going on vacation with a boyfriend, a rather new boyfriend. And she said, you got anything for me to read on the trip? I said, yeah, take my book. She took her book, my book, and she came back. I said, how's vacation? How's the book? She said, well, she said, I was reading your book and I realized that I was on a vacation with Jeff.
Oh, right.
And
I got
was
shivers.
Terrified.
Yeah.
And she said she decided she was going to leave early, and he had made the plane arrangements and I guess bought the tickets. And she said to him, I'm going, it's not working. And she got on the bus to the airport. And when she got to the airport, he had deleted her ticket. So she had no ticket. I mean, and she said to me, had I not been reading your book, I would not have seen the signals. I would not have known. So I thought, well, this is powerful.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing too. I think there is, we need, you know, everybody needs to feel like their feelings about something are justified, right? We need to feel like we're not, like you said, we're not being thin-skinned, we're not being wimpy, we're not whiny, we're not like, you know, and it's interesting too, because Jeff was in 9/11, right? I mean, he's, you know, he's a hero. I mean, he lived through something really horrible, and he probably has his own story, like what caused him to be the way he is. And we don't discount that. We're not saying that Jeff isn't that he doesn't have his own stuff that he that is valid, and he hasn't been hurt in his own way, that doesn't give him permission to do this thing. But from the outside, of course, you know, there's many situations where the man is sort of the, like in this case, actually, Ellie has a job, which I think is very powerful. And the more, you know, I was listening to, I don't know if it's Jane Font, one of these fabulous older women who was talking about how the moment a woman doesn't have her own, you know, source of income or career, she gives up so much power. Yes. And, you know, it's an impossible thing in a world where somebody has to raise our children and two working parents is hardly sustainable for sort of the kids, unless you have parents nearby, which, you know, we never did. And so one parent always has to sort of give and be sort of less employed, if you will. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes women are just the ones who do it because we have to take maternity leave because we have the baby. And we, you know, there's a bond that happens that the mothers more, you know, more often want to be home. Or if not, then the men are often paid more because that's also the setup of the world. And it does immediately put us at this sort of power disadvantage. And I am, one of the things I'm grateful in my divorce is that I always had a career, right? That I'm not, because I do have, all of a sudden I'm 53 and like a half dozen of my closest friends are going through like the exact thing. Their husbands have been cheating or, you know, whatever. I'm not going to out all my friends, but you know what I'm saying? They, a lot of us going through the exact same thing. And some of those women just, they didn't work because that was the setup. And then their husbands, you know, believe that they don't deserve, those women, because they didn't work, don't deserve half of the, you know, marital estate.
Mindset. Here, I'll take care of you. Oh, you can't take care of yourself? Too bad. You know, that's quite, and I think that's, when I look back on my child raising years and all my friends, everybody worked and people jumped through all sorts of hoops, night shifts, day shifts, evening shifts, 3 days on, 3 days off to have a parent or a reliable babysitter at home. It's very difficult. I don't imagine it's going to get much easier. Certainly where I live in Los Angeles, you've got to have two incomes.
Yeah. It is hard. And yeah, and exactly. And the people who don't have, I mean, so I live in Montana where, you know, really a one income family is quite normal. It's much, at least it was. Bozeman's gotten a little insane, but after the pandemic, everybody thought they wanted to be part of Yellowstone. So, but basically, you know, we did for, you know, a lot of people for a lot of time didn't. And even if I had, you know, women would work, like you said, they would work part-time 3 days a week, take a night shift. It wasn't the same sort of career trajectory that the men had. And so Now that, you know, now when the marriage is ending, you know, there's this sense that the men don't, they, you know, they earned the money. I've actually heard that from my own husband, who I think was very respectful of my job. There were moments in that negotiation, because money makes everybody ugly. You know, we all, you know, it makes us fight. Yeah, it does. And it's, you know, and there were moments where he was like, but I made most of the money. And I was like, I raised most of the kids. Like, you know, there's
and wrote 17 books.
Yeah.
And 20 years. Hello.
Yeah, I know. But that, you know, it, in an ideal world, that would have been a really, that would have been a very stable income. But as we know, writing is not that. It is a lot of things. And I'm grateful for it, but it is not a stable income. So yeah, so I think that it's set up to make it in a way that makes it hard for women. But one of the things I appreciate with, you know, Ellie's relationship with Hannah and the relationship I have with my kids is that and they're 24 and 22, so they're grown. But when they need something, when they want to talk something through, they call me. And that is a gift. I feel like I earned it, but that is a gift that I wouldn't trade for, you know, $1 billion. My children, I have the relationship with them, and they're mad at their dad, and they will forgive him because he is a really good dad. But they, you know, but I'm their person, and I get shivers talking about that. So I feel like Ellie has that too.
She has it with Hannah. Yeah. And I loved Hannah, and I remember writing her, and I remember not being able to start her chapter because I couldn't get a handle on where to start her. Sometimes I started her with being a little kid in New York City. Sometimes I started her with, how does she feel about her daddy surviving 9/11?
Right.
And then all of a sudden I thought, put her in the present right now on the phone with her, texting with her best friend. And all of a sudden I saw her.
Yeah.
And I knew who she was and what she was doing and where she was. That's actually something that my editor, the great Celia Johnson, she's a freelance editor. She taught me something really amazing about writing. And I'm using it in my second book right now. She said, so a lot of my book, Ellie or Jeff would be ruminating about something. They'd be thinking, oh, you know, in the past, blah, blah, blah. Or they'd be thinking about something that had just happened. And they weren't rooted in a space or time that was visible to the
right.
So Celia said, no, just put her in the room, you know, describe where she is. She in bed on her laptop? Is the cat there? And all of a sudden, I thought, oh, that's perfect. And she also said, readers forget from chapter to chapter, especially if you're going back and forth between Jeff and Ellie and you're in a chat room, they forget where they left off. And I'm guilty of that because I read before I go to sleep. And so I conk out after 10 pages. Yeah. And so she said, pick it up from the last chapter.
Yeah.
You know, how does she feel? Is she thinking about that? And I thought, well, that is such a valuable piece of information. And now that I'm reading the other authors that I love, everyone's doing it. You know, that's the preferred way to do it. And I also remember when one of my friends was reading a very, very early draft, she called me halfway through. She said, I don't want to stop reading to go look this up. Who's Wendy? Wendy's her sister. And then I realized, if Wendy doesn't show up for 90 pages, you better remind people who she is.
Yes.
So all these ways of grounding the reader and guiding them with a firm hand through your story was really valuable to me and went along with changes.
People don't want to be, readers don't want to be frustrated. They don't want to have to look back and figure out who Wendy is. They don't want to try to figure out where they are. And it doesn't, you know, the funny thing is, as a reader, you don't even really notice how the author has told you, has put you in this place and surrounded you, because it just, you just take it in. But yeah, I, you know what, I'm however many books in, I still have these same things. I have to remind myself, where are we? Like, what, you know, what is happening? Right. What is, and it's interesting to write a first book. I mean, so, and obviously, you know, now, right, you tell us about writing a second book, because everybody talks about sort of the pressure, because you have all the time in the world to write a first book, right? I mean, it can take as long as it takes. And a second book, they're usually like, okay, we'd like this in a year. So how, you know, how is that?
Thankfully, my publisher has not said we'd like this in a year. And I don't know how to think about that. I don't know if that's good news or bad news, but my goal is to have it in a year.
Yeah.
And it's... So in For Worse, Ellie at her worst moments imagines that she has a lovely husband, and she calls him Phantom Husband, and he pops up occasionally in her imagination. So I thought, what if a woman has a imaginary husband and kind of takes it to the nth degree?
Yeah.
So that's part of my second novel. But there's also in For Worse, you're sort of heading towards an event. And in this new novel, there's already a body. Mm-hmm. So I have to delve into police procedural, mm-hmm. which scares me to death, because I really don't want to get on the phone with a policewoman in Boston and say, I'm writing a novel. Now, I know, I'm sure you've done it. You've also done it, because I'm reading your books and they're procedurals. And, you know, but I guess I don't have the confidence as a novelist yet to say, yeah, I'm a novelist and I'm doing research for my novel and I just need to pick your brain for a minute.
Well, there are quite a number of wonderful Facebook groups about police officers. So, because my first book came out when I was 29. So I met a police officer who was married to a woman I work with in finance. And that was my entree, because I would be also super awkward to pick up a phone and call. But then I discovered there are really wonderful Facebook groups. So you could probably find, you know, a Boston police, or you can certainly find general police, and they might refer you to somebody. But I got referred to, like, I met a, he was a sort of part of a sharpshooter group. And then I met a sex crimes inspector through him. And then I met a homicide inspector through her. And then I met, you know, so, and that was always, it was sort of passed around from person to person. And to be honest, Lynn, my experience has been that if you write and say that, you know, I'm writing a book where the police is a, you know, I want to make it real. I want the police to show up in a really good way. Like I'm not writing the book about the crooked cop. Then mm-hmm. they are so happy to share with you because they want the cops to show up as good people. They get enough bad press, right? The police mm-hmm. are not on everybody's most, you know, likable list. So they really are super generous. But in the meantime, you can find all sorts of, in fact, you know, offline, if you email me or message me, I will find the one that I have referred to sometimes. And usually you can get somebody and you can start to private message them, you know, and just get what you need. So
that's fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah. And also a lot of our listeners and readers, it's amazing to me, are, you know, I would think if you were a police officer, the last thing you'd want to do would be read books about your job. But a lot of people are. And I did a whole series about a medical examiner. That's the Schwartzman, Annabelle Schwartzman. And people reached out and said, if you ever need help, I work in a pathologist's office or mm-hmm. I work, you know, which is lovely, you know, because people want to, it's fun to be part of a creative process and people are incredibly generous. So, in fact, if you're listening to this and you are a police officer or know somebody who is a police officer in Boston, leave us a comment. Tell Lynn how to get in touch because, yeah, we want to get it right. I understand why that's scary. It's all scary. I mean, how to work a gun, how to build a, you know, if you're going to build a bomb or use technology or, you know, and we mess it up. Of course we do.
Even talk to some, you know, I mean, I'm so in awe of the way police talk to people to get their information. They're a little cagey, you know, they know what they want to keep back and want. And I feel like I don't want to be an idiot, you know,
And I think, but also like I have found too, to be like, okay, I have no police experience. You know, I dream it up in my head, but it's all coming from my head, which means really there's no official training. So help me get it right. And people are, they're incredibly generous. So there's lots of good places, but I totally understand that. And I understand that there's this, you know, researching while you're writing a book is a funny thing too, because you need to know enough, right? But if you can also find yourself down a lot of rabbit holes, right?
Oh God,
you're
day.
I only needed to figure out the difference between a revolver and a pistol. And here I am 3 days down the rabbit hole of guns, you know, or whatever.
Exactly.
So, yeah. Well, that's exciting. And are you finding the second book process is it different in some way? Is it feel more pressure, less pressure?
I feel like there's more pressure, because, you know, I don't know what's going to happen to this book, you know, we'll publish it again or not. And I also feel that, there's not as much. So when the first book was about a woman with retinitis pigmentosa, and a lot of it is how I feel about having that challenge in my life. And a lot of it was expressing my feelings about it, which was very, freeing and I hope educating a bit without being preachy. And so this has not a lot of me personally in it. So I'm a little bit, other than the fact that I love my characters and I'm committed to telling their story. And I also think that I'm again I'm in a place where a woman or two are controlled by their husbands without being aware of it. And the idea here is not so much the controlling is the fact that your reality gets skewed when you're in a relationship that is, you're not being filtered the right information from the outside. You're in it. You don't know what it looks like.
Right.
And so you can tell that you're not in reality. So I think the arc of these two women are to find their reality, their real reality, and not the reality that's imposed by someone else.
Right. Well, I mean, it's not, you know, as you said, there's less of you, and yet you talk, you know, you're with universal themes that have so much potency in terms of the power of story, and also the power of, you know, making people who are going through these things feel, you know, feel the reality of their situation. And hopefully, like you said, maybe, you know, women read these books. I hope they read these books and think, okay, wait, I think I'm in this kind of relationship, and, you know, or I was, and I didn't realize, you know, I got out of it, but I got out of it in an ugly way, and I'm blamed or whatever. And they get to see it, you know, it from a different perspective, and hopefully feel somewhat empowered. That's, you know, it's funny that sort of the dance between preaching, you know, about, and I don't hate men. I sometimes say that I have to say that more often because
I don't either.
Right, of course.
I don't either. I wrote this man who's kind of a monster, but I don't hate men at all.
Of course not. Right. It's not that. It is, but I do feel like there's plenty of people, there's plenty of authors who do a really wonderful job of like highlighting the incredible aspects of being a man. Plenty of them. And they've been around for a long time and they've been doing it forever. And so in my mind, like, that's not my role. Somebody else is doing that. My role is to highlight the sort of dark aspects of what it is to be a woman, and this, and the fear that goes along with it, you know, and the power, but sort of to just like shine a little light on that in a way that hopefully doesn't feel like you're raising one to bash the other, because it isn't not a zero sum game, men and women. But I appreciate that with the space that you're filling, because I think we do need those books, and they are incredibly, you know, helpful. So.
Thank you.
And so is the new book called Phantom Husband?
No.
Okay. Well, we won't talk about it because you're in the process and we don't want to ruin any of the magic. So, okay. So tell us, where can we find you online, Lynn? Where is the best way to connect?
I have a website, authorlkbowen.com. Mm-hmm. That's author, not Arthur. When I first created the website, there's an actor from Harry Potter. His name is Arthur Bowen. And every time I typed in author LK Bowen, a zillion pages for Arthur Bowen came up.
Funny.
Please type in AUTHRNOR.
Yeah, there you go.
And then I'm on Instagram at author_LK Bowen. And then I'm not on Facebook or Twitter because I just can't.
It's too much. Right. Exactly.
It's too much.
I totally appreciate that. I know it's all too much. We have to write books too. Well, Lynn, it was so fun to get a chance to talk to you today about For Worse. And I wish you the best of luck with that. Everybody, thank you for joining us today with Lynn Bowen and For Worse, her book out. Such a fun read.
April 2nd.
Such an evil twist. And we'll see you next time. Bye.
Thank you so much, Danielle. Bye-bye.